Music from Lenny LeBlanc. The song is called The Rain. We're heard for Mary Catherine, her song Savior, and it's 11 minutes after the hour. It's a Monday, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments, board member with Creation Moments, a resident of Garden Valley, Texas, and he grows grapes down there, and comments on things creationist, evolutionist, science, faith. That's kind of our realm of discussion. Don, welcome. Good morning to you. Happy Monday.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. How are you folks this morning?
Good, good, Don. How about
just,
you?
Just fine. Yeah.
I'm doing well. Y'all aren't snowed in, are you?
Well, no, as a matter, it's been kind of warm. We had an interesting combination of frost and fog the other day, which you don't see often up here, but that's froggy weather, we call it. You combine the two, and the snow is yet to come. It's cooled off today. We're in the mid-20s right now. How about how are your grapes doing down there? Is it still temperate?
Well, they're starting to get dormant. There's still leaves on them, but the leaves are starting to shrivel up. So they should lose their leaves here in probably a couple of weeks. I mean, in next frost, they will probably drop most of their leaves.
And I'd love to ask. I have more questions about grapes than I have about clay, but clay is the topic today.
There's a new business in a neighboring town, Crosby. So 2,000-3,000 people. And there's a new business. A couple of young folks have opened up a winemaking wine house. It's called Our Wine House. And what they're doing is they're reselling kits, wine kits. And you add water and you put it in the bottle and you wait. And then when the little bubble pops up, then it's wine. And so I stopped in and visited for a while. There were a couple of customers making... pasting labels on a bottle, and he gave me a bottle because I expressed interest in the wine and, threw a couple of big terms at him. So he said, hey, this guy might know what he's talking about. So he gave me a bottle of the wine. It was a Chilean Malbec.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good.
And it was pleasant wine. It was, nothing that blew your head off. And it was okay. It was well-balanced. I was really surprised at how well balanced it was. But, after the second glass, I reflected and I said, there's nothing. Malbec is a difficult grape to categorize anyway, because it's a blending grape in Bordeaux and usually typically not made on its own. But there was nothing that was characteristic about Malbec in that glass, in that bottle. And it was a pleasant tasting wine. But
let me see if I can create a segue here. Do Malbec vines, do they grow in clay by chance?
Sort of. Well, I've been told that my feet are made of clay.
There's a connection there. Well, wine can be a lot more interesting than dirt, I suppose. But this is not just any dirt. We're talking about clay here. And there's a research out of Cornell University that says there are little tiny spaces in the clay where some kind of chemical reaction happens. Dr. Don, what are they talking about? What kind of a chemical reaction are they referring to?
Oh, well, this is a rather involved type of experiment that they did. And they said, voila, you see, we've found the origins of life. What they're doing is using clay. Some forms of clay actually produce a hydrogel, or you put it in water and it kind of gels up. It's not just the clay that you'd find necessarily in the ground.
It's a specific kind of clay then, okay.
Yeah, and they didn't mention whether it was bentonite that the oil industry uses, but it could have been.
Well, does it occur naturally someplace, this substance, this kind of clay?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, because, this. Let me just step back a little bit what these researchers were trying to do.
Yeah.
They're trying to find a cheap way for making proteins. Right now, biotechnology uses complete cells to synthesize proteins and all the mechanisms inside the cell. Where they would, insert a gene, for example, that would express the protein that they're interested in, and then they have a pretty big job of cleaning all that up and isolating the protein of interest. So these folks have been working in hydrogels for the specific purpose of trying to find a kind of a protective environment where they can throw their DNA and presumably ribosomes and activated amino acids, for example, everything that you would normally have inside the cell to make proteins, and throw it all together, and hopefully the hydrogel would protect the DNA from being chewed up and broken apart.
So this was not done to prove evolution. This was not connected with the theory of evolution. This was a scientific effort to find a safe place where these chemical reactions could occur so they could do their research.
That's right. Gotcha. And okay. The article really didn't go into what they used initially, but they were looking for whatever it was apparently pretty expensive, and you couldn't scale it up too well. So this one research assistant, or even a graduate student or postdoc, said, "Well, you know, let me try clay." And it turned out that whatever clay that they were using, and it probably was bentonite, because that's pretty common clay. It forms, it not only forms the hydrogel, but they were more interested in the spaces in the clay. And it turned out that they had better results in the clay than they did in the other hydrogels that they were looking at, which were probably some type of synthetic polymer. So that meant, well, gee, we have a cheap source. We've kind of achieved our goal. We have a cheap source of you know, the hydrogel, which this clay now is not only creating these protective pockets so that you know, our DNA doesn't degrade and we can get the proteins out that we want. You know, the side effect of all of this was, well, let's just speculate as far as we can.
To this assumption, critical to this postulation would be the fact that this clay occurs naturally. So, you know, it's in the ground, on the earth, in various places. And so what was their conclusion then?
Well, the conclusion was the clay is a good to use if you're trying to manufacture proteins, but you have to obviously input all of the other chemicals needed in order to manufacture proteins, and it's not just
they would
the
introduce
DNA.
These things into the spaces within the clay then.
Yeah, and they probably just, you know, mixed in their DNA and mixed in their activated amino acids enzymes.
Would they just stir it up?
I mean, I would think so. Okay. Yeah, they probably just stirred it up very gently, because if you stir DNA up too vigorously, it breaks apart. So then you have a problem. Mm-hmm. And you mix all that stuff up, you get ribosomes. Probably they had some ribosomes, because that's the enzyme that actually, transforms. Well, then they would have to, if they're starting with DNA, they'd have to make messenger RNA out of that. I'm really surprised that they started with DNA, but I'd have to read their original research to find out why they started with DNA, and the article says DNA, but it's messenger RNA that actually you use to make proteins, and then you need transfer RNA with your amino acids attached to them to match up with the messenger RNA.
Okay, so this is more complex than using an eyedropper of DNA and putting in two drops, and then two drops of RNA, and then something else, and stirring up the clay. This is a little more delicate than that. Okay.
So if they started with DNA, then they'd have to use an enzyme that would copy, for example, the code off the DNA, making messenger RNA, and then from the messenger RNA, they would have to have the ribosomes, which is the very complex enzyme that causes the chemical reaction to take place between two transfer RNA molecules that actually have the amino acids, which is what you're finally
pardon my ignorance here, but you're the biochemist in the group. Are enzymes living things, or are they just chemicals?
They're huge macromolecules with kind of active sites. The easiest thing to think of them as is catalyst, basically.
But they're chemicals then, not living things themselves.
No, they're not living things.
Okay.
Not living things at all. Mm. But they're, you know, they're pretty huge, especially ribosomes, are pretty huge proteins. And so they're throwing all of this, you know, it sounds like in the mix, and voila, they're getting their proteins out. Mm-hmm. And I'll say something about that later. But what they... then they go on after that, you know, they were successful with this particular experiment. They go on to say that, well, you know, maybe this is how life started, you know, here on Earth. They make the gigantic leap that, you know, we created proteins from non-life, if you will. Now, bear in mind that everything that they're using was made by life somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's not really abiogenesis, which means not by life, basically. Well,
isn't it a scientific precept, a basic supposition that life cannot come from non-life? Or is that the crux of the evolutionary argument, that it can and did?
Yeah, well, yeah, that is the crux. That is the crux. That it's abiogenesis for sure. Mm-hmm.
That is abiogenesis is life from nothing.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah, that's what Stephen Hawking said that. Okay. He said that, mm-hmm. well, you know, given the right conditions, that was Stephen Hawking. Given the right conditions, life can come from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Or the universe can create itself.
Well, yeah, that's going one step even further back than that, but so their supposition here is that, well, you know, we can show that with this clay hydrogel, we can get our reactions to go, so maybe this is how life began to form early in the primordial soup. So the actual hydrogel itself, these clay hydrogels, form these little pockets, which then protected the larger macromolecules, which allowed them to react the way they do in the cell. And voila, we've got the beginnings of life being formed.
Well, do you suppose the assumption was that, well, aha, this is how it must have started, or aha, perhaps... we should look into this further and see if this could have served that purpose then. I mean, did they jump to the evolutionary bandwagon immediately? Is it that great a leap that they took with this?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's that great a leap. It's not like, well, this is interesting. This is an interesting finding. But, you know, there's many, many, many steps in between to go from taking all the reactants, if you will, and putting them in a clay hydrogel and then coming out with proteins to let's just start with nucleotides, for example, which would be and mix them all together and see if we get DNA out of it, mm-hmm. which is or messenger RNA or something. It's a tremendous leap. And it's interesting how we keep going back to this article, to this concept of abiogenesis, and of basically chemistry, chemicals to man type of approach in this evolutionary thinking, because even, you know, these guys, you know, had to be are pretty smart, but because, you know, you see life and you say, well, okay, I don't believe there's a God, or maybe I do believe there's a God, but I've been programmed to think that evolution really happened. And so I've got to come up with an explanation as to how that possibly could have happened. And my research kind of points in that direction. So, you know, we're just going to speculate that, hey, here's a possible explanation. But they're dealing with, say, possible. I mean, it's like, this is the way.
Here it is. We found it.
Yeah. It happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's it really is kind of, I won't say ludicrous to think this way, but it is... you know, stretching the point beyond reason.
Well, there is something called the big lie technique. You normally hear that term applied to politics, international relations, to conducting war, and seldom to science. But this seems to me to be a situation where the big lie technique is at work equally. It's really human psychology is what it is. If you say it long enough and loud enough, people tend to believe it. And so I guess I would pose this question: is then, in fact, in the world today, is evolution mainstream, or are there just enough people shouting that it's mainstream that we believe it is? I mean, is there another side that is maybe less visible, but just as strenuous in its proclamation that it is not the case? Are there really two sides to this?
Oh, there's definitely two sides, but you don't hear in the public forum the other side. Hmm. So what will make big news? I mean, this is the irony of the whole thing. Not necessarily irony, but this is how propaganda, this type of propaganda gets. You know, this story was probably picked up. I don't know how many, different news agencies picked up this story.
Well, we saw a couple different places. The one where I'm reading right now is at GodfatherPolitics.com, and it's on the creationist side of the coin. And there was the other article, and I've frankly forgotten where it was from. Might have been the Huffington Post, something like that, that picked up this report out of Cornell University about clay and about the spaces in the clay and what may or may not have occurred there. But the assumption was, aha, that's where evolution happens.
Right. And that's the side that you typically hear, you see, because this story is, well, we're just tooting our horns, and here's, creationist, here's another piece of evidence for you that shows that evolution really did take place. And this does not prove anything. I mean, all it proves is that, okay, well, you can do your reactions in clay. Mm-hmm. And it seems to give you a little bit better results than a hydrogel. And you can't really do your reactions too well if you just use water, for example, or a saline solution. Saltwater solution. That doesn't prove that this is how all things started. Bear in mind that they are using tremendously large, macromolecules in their research. They're not, like I said, they're not starting with small molecules. They're not starting with small amino acids or small the nucleotides, the components that make up, DNA or RNA. They're not starting with that. They're starting with already, completed stuff. So the protein that they made had to be fairly expensive at that point, because your reagents that you're using are pretty expensive, because you have to isolate them either from cells or, or wherever you're getting them. The answer to, they're trying to find a economically cheap, let's say, process for making proteins. I don't think they've done it, because their reagents are probably so expensive. Easier to grow cells, and even the difficulty in isolating the protein, it's easier to grow cells in a in tissue culture media in various forms than it is to try to isolate all the chemicals and all the macromolecules that they used in this particular experiment.
Well, and we can even talk about this on a higher level, a more general level, I suppose. And if we can assume that evolution has the momentum now, that's what's got the attention of much of the scientific world, does that then put creationists in the position of having to disprove evolution? How do you prove that something didn't happen?
Well, obviously that's much more difficult the position to come by, but what the creationists have done, you know, in the past is say, well, you know, you claim that this is evidence for evolution. Here's all the reasons why it can't be evidence for evolution, and you know, some of them I enumerated.
You point out the logical flaws. Yeah.
Yeah, you find the flaws in the argument, and you say, you know, nah, I'm sorry, that just doesn't cut it. And then you do research to show that if the creation, if creation is correct, then you do experiments to, you know, show that, well, here's all the reasons why, you know, creation. So you kind of take the same approach. And since we're talking about, you know, the origins of life, it's no one's going to prove one side or the other. In reality, what you do is you stack up enough evidence on one side and enough evidence against the other side, and you say which one seems more logical. And there, clearly in my mind, that the creationists have a more logical argument than the evolutionists.
Well, you know, if this was purely a scientific argument, then I could accept what you just said. But because there's theology involved, because there's culture and humanity involved, and whole belief systems, it may behoove evolutionists simply to sell their idea, not prove it, which I think is what's happened.
Well, very much so. And, mm-hmm. you know, the ardent evolutionist will absolutely demand that evolution has been proven without a doubt, which is hogwash. It's just, you know, I can't say that enough. It's just baloney.
Well, this article says it rather succinctly, I think. And let me just read a couple paragraphs here. In this article over at godfatherpolitics.com, it says, the charge is often made that the debate over evolution is over. Evolution has been proven to be a fact beyond dispute. The problem with evolution is that evolutionists, especially those of the atheistic type, in parentheses, can't account for matter, organized information, and non-material entities like love, compassion, and morality that make us uniquely human. I think that cuts to the quick there.
Well, it does, because even if, you know, and I'm not saying we did evolve, but even if that was the mechanism, you still have those, you know, those qualities of life, especially, you know, humans, and you see some of these qualities even in animals that you can't explain. Mm-hmm. But then there's so many other things that you can't explain. I mean, why things, you know, happened the way they happened, and it just so happens that it, you know, things work so well, and that, you know, even Darwin himself said, I'm paraphrasing greatly here, he said, you know, during his time, and it's interesting that the Cornell article even kind of suggests this, but during his time, the inside of the cell, I mean, they didn't have microscopes powerful enough to be able to see all the stuff that's inside the cell and all the order that's inside the cell. He said, and it was, you know, they thought it was just a mix of chemicals and, you know, just another form of encapsulated primordial soup, for example. But Darwin said something to the effect that if you ever show that, you know, life is complex, my arguments just are completely fall apart. Mm-hmm. And we have gone beyond the showing that it's not only complex, but there is superstructure upon superstructure. There is molecular machines inside the cell, inside the nucleus of the cell, outside the cell. There is scaffolding all over the cell that reactions, you know, take place in a very orderly matter. There are proteins that escort other proteins, for example, from one place to another place. There are proteins that cause the folding of proteins. so that they're in the right configuration, so that they're actually active and not just a long string of amino acids just linked together. The cell is so complex that, you know, people have spent a lifetime just studying one aspect, one series of chemical reactions in order to figure it out. And yet, even in the article in Cornell, they basically saying, well, you know, the protoplasm, and they leave you with this idea that the protoplasm is just this primordial soup that's encapsulated. Mm-hmm. Again, which is what, you know, Darwin thought. And it's, you know, so that's the deception, that life is simple and we can break these down into just its molecular components. We can mix these components together and voila, we get life again. No such thing. You know, if we take the theological point of view and we read in Genesis chapter, you know, 2 that, and it's an interesting chapter because it goes along with the clay theory, but from a different perspective. And it, you know, it says God formed man from clay, and then but then he breathed the breath of life into him. So even if you have all the molecules, you know, in place, you still don't have a living being until, you know, God actually breathed into it. So
and of course breath this is more than theology, this is linguistics also. Breath, spirit, very much the same kind of feeling. Breath, spirit, wind. Even Jesus talks about the spirit and the wind, or likens them, compares them. So what we're saying is this is like a third element. The element of spirit had to be present in order for life to occur.
That's right. And especially, you know, especially man.
Maybe exclusively.
So, yeah. And chapter 2, you know, elaborates on the, you know, on the creation of man, for example. And so, you know, we want to break this down and make it as simple as possible so as many people can understand it and give a somewhat reasonable story as to how things started, so that people don't, you know, believe in the creation worldview and believe in God. I mean, that is the bottom line. We're talking not about, you know, necessarily evolution and creation. We're talking about whether or not you believe in God or not.
Well, yeah, and now it's illegal to talk about that in schools. You know, how do you pass on that knowledge? You've got to do it in families and outside the civic environment, I guess, to reach children so that they at least keep an open mind on the subject.
Well, yeah, now you get into politics, you get into, you know, what we've allowed to happen in our schools, and that was the plan all along, was to eliminate God from the education of our children.
Yeah, whose plan?
Well, John Dewey, from the very beginning of having public schools, was his plan, in part of you know, of this system of bringing us into a big government control, you know, of our lives that we are experiencing even today.
Well, how do evolutionists deal with the evidence that you just listed for us of things becoming more complex as they get smaller? I have not heard an evolutionist comment on that.
They don't comment on it.
Yeah, and they can't comment. They would reference you back to, for example, the article that we, you know, talked about this morning and say, well, you see, you don't necessarily need compartments within a cell to get these reactions to go. You know, all the things that go into place to make, you know, to make biological life, they just wave their hands and they say, well, the argument kind of goes like this, because we are here, it had to happen. And, you know, it had to happen. If you're an atheist, Yes, okay, well, you're here, and if you don't believe in God, then it had to happen some way, and this seems to be the best explanation that we have today for how it happened.
With that original quantifier, well, that will consider anything about supernatural involvement here.
That's right, and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to consider that, because then I would have to admit that there is a God, and if there is a God, and this God is, you know, a God of judgment, an all-loving God, but a God of judgment.
Is there a middle ground? We only got a couple more minutes, but is there a middle ground? Is it possible to believe in God and accept at least part of the evolution scheme of things?
Well, is it possible? There are people who believe in evolution and who believe in God. And one would call that theistic evolution, that God used evolution to form man and to form the animals, and it happened over eons of time. The problem with that is it does start breaking down. It's kind of a compromise of Scripture. And once you compromise Scripture from the very first, verse, if you will, and first chapters of the Bible, then how do you tell which is, which is true and what is just a story? Mm-hmm. And even in, even in Sunday school, we tell our kids, and I think this is a gross mistake, we tell our kids, well, you're going to go to your special class and you're going to hear a Bible story. Well, you go to the movies and what are you watching? You're watching a fictitious story, most of the time. And so they get the concept that a story is fictional. So when they get to college or even, high school, all of this is torn down and saying, well, that's just, what you heard in Sunday school is just a story, and it's not really how it is. Let me tell you how it really is. And so they start telling kids that, the Earth is millions and millions of years old. The universe is, 13.7, 13.8 billion years old. And we evolved, from your grandfather was actually a rock, or in this case, a piece of clay. Mm-hmm. Your great, 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 great grandfather. And there's no difference from you than an ape. I could just go on and on, but... mm-hmm. This is what we're up against, and it starts in our churches with the education of our children, our churches have not been firm on this point that we will not compromise Scripture, that Scripture is the ultimate truth and we need to stand by it.
David and I have talked a number of times about our notion. I think both of us share this feeling that there's a point in time when things turned over, started going downhill. You mentioned John Dewey. We've talked about archaeology in the Holy Land in the 1890s and the intrusion of German archaeologists who were concluding things non-biblical, the Deuteronomical theory of the Pentateuch and so forth, that it was written later than the Bible scholars used to think. It's like, and it happened in law. There are some who would connect this downturn in law that is extracting God from the process and not even recognizing the fundamentals of common law, in the Ten Commandments. But this was a president of Harvard that came in the 1890s. It seems to be that time period, 1880s, maybe just post-Civil War, that period in at least American history when things started turning toward evolution and kind of a rationalistic approach and eliminating the spiritual. Would you agree to that or disagree?
Oh, no, I would very much agree to it, and it probably happened very, very early. Like I said, John Dewey, even with, the concepts of Darwin in his book kind of kicked it off, in Charles Lyell before that, and this concept of, even in geology, of long periods of time. Mm-hmm. So what we see today is we don't see absolutes. We see relativistic type of arguments being made. in our courtroom. The law, for example, in your law schools are not teaching constitutionalism. They're teaching that the law is constantly evolving to meet the needs of the people. Well, it's not the needs of the people that they're really interested in. It's the very selfish needs of them of themselves. And you know, a lot of the students that come out of law school, you know, wind up going into politics.
And yeah, we've heard about that.
You know, now you're changing society by the evolutionary laws that you're making.
Well, this would be then social Darwinism.
Yes, exactly, and it creeps into to every aspect of our life. See, it's this big lie that Satan wants to perpetrate on people. First, he tells them, "Oh, there's no God." And then if you believe that there's no God, then, well, there's certainly no Satan. And then Satan has is free to reign in our thoughts to promote a philosophy, worldview, if you will, that is void of anything godly.
Interesting. We could go into this forever, I think. And Don, we always delight in the rabbit trails we discover when we talk to you. We've gone from clay to social Darwinism and politics, religion, theology, law. Anything we haven't covered, David? Anything we need to touch on to make it complete here?
I'm reading a book called Coming Apart, and it's by Charles Murray, who is a social scientist, and you know, is probably his best known book is The Bell Curve. And he wrote it with the guy by the name of Hernberg a number of years ago. But Murray looks at the same kinds of things that you're talking about, Don, as far as the devolution of social capital in this country. And, you know, things don't mean what they at one time had meant. Now, in this particular book's case, what he predicted in The Bell Curve was that eventually people will self-segregate based on their intelligence, and that smart people will marry other smart people, and they will have smart kids, and they'll live in conclaves. They'll live in small areas where just smart people live. Well, it hasn't quite gotten to that point yet.
So intellect results in social and economic compartmentalization, I suppose you could say.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah, and Murray is talking in this book. I mean, the portion that I just finished reading is that in the last 50 years among white people, social capital has dropped like a rock, even in those areas where the intelligent, the cognitive elite live, but especially among those areas that where people have maybe not finished high school or as a maximum have finished high school. Over the last 40 years, membership in clubs, attendance in church, the breakdown of the family, you know, the core of the society that we've known for the last 200 or 300 years is falling apart. And he said, particularly in those areas where the predominant intellectual level has never gone beyond an education in high school, indicating that people there are not incredibly all that smart. You really can't relate those two. Just because you didn't finish high school doesn't mean you're not smart.
Well, you separate high school to college, you could also make the assertion that even in college, at the university levels, people aren't getting the quality of education they used to get.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's another one of the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it would be
another one of the
logically.
Another one of the results, because now college has become, you know, a kind of a certification process. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you can sit still for 4 years and sit in a class somewhere and repeat the inanities that your professor throws at you and get a somewhat passing grade, now in the day after, forget everything you've ever learned, and you can go out and get a job.
You know, this is all in keeping with Dr. Don's theory of devolution, which we have mentioned any number of times. And I would submit to you that perhaps the smart people that remain have just about all moved to Texas.
Well,
that's very possible.
We still have some pretty non-smart people, even in Texas. We had one of our Texas law professors made a statement at a kind of an anti-gun rally recently, you know, saying that we absolutely need to get rid of the Second Amendment because it serves no purpose today. Well, you know, in reality, it serves more purpose today than it did, you know, 50 years ago.
It's more vital now than it ever has.
So, I mean, it's we've got pockets of.
Well, okay. Maybe they just moved to Garden Valley, Texas, then, because Don, we certainly appreciate you and enjoy your visits with us each and every Monday. Don, a biochemist and a member of the board at Creation Moments. By the way, I want to mention the website creationmoments.com. The ministry celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And it's a good place for resources on creationism and the book of Genesis, a lot of scientific information there for you. If you're curious about the other side of the argument, it's a great place to visit creationmoments.com, and you can link there from our website, brokenroadradio.com.
Don, can I throw in one final thought?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay.
Throw away.
Okay, one final thought. Mm-hmm. And inside my there's a little voice screaming inside of me that says, gee, wouldn't this be a really interesting thing to watch when somebody, like in the past, like all of the other great scientific discoveries, you know, Ptolemy and Galileo and Copernicus and all of the rest of those, and Isaac Newton and the deep thinkers, wouldn't it be nice if one of those superstars got up and went on Jay Leno TV one night and said, hi, I'm the best scientist ever in the world, and everybody respects my words, and all this evolution stuff is nonsense. And wouldn't it be
an authority from
to see
the
fallout?
Would be an attention getter, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the guy would be lynched in the parking lot, probably. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't it be interesting to see the fallout, and would that start the ball rolling?
The interesting notion.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting. That's a discussion for another topic. I mean, another time.
Well, maybe Monday, and I count me in because I mean that's the, I keep. And I'm looking through the binoculars through the wrong end when I say this, but it seems to me that every time we talk about evolution, that everybody else in the world's having the same conversation, and that's not the case, of course. Most other people just kind of don't talk about this and say, well, my 10th grade high school instructor said this, so it must be true. Mm-hmm. But people don't think for themselves. Well, and it's only after
what I would give my right arm for
slowly led to an idea, do they start to accept it?
What I would love to see is simply people dealing with the science instead of casting aspersions on the other side, because ridicule is the first line of defense of a scoundrel. And I hear that coming from the evolutionists every time the word creationism pops up.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I hear it from the other side too. Condemnation as atheists, and I hear condemnation. I don't hear, like we do here in our conversations with Dr. Don, here we address the science. But out in the world of public information and education and politics and science, that rule of ridicule seems to prevail, and it's kind of a sad thing. I'd just like to deal with the science, really would. Don, as always, thank you for joining us today. Have a good week.
Thank you.
We'll see you next Monday. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Don.